I'm in Cubbett Square in Canary Wharf, which is the heart of London's financial district. I'm just a stone's throw from the Thames River. I'm surrounded by streets named after European explorers. Columbus Courtyard, Frobisher Passage, Willoughby Passage. So who's Cabot? Excuse me, guys. I'm just doing some recording about this square. You know, it's called Cabot Square.
Yep.
Do you know who Cabot is?
No idea at all?
No.
Would you be surprised if I told you he was the first European explorer to discover the Americas after Columbus?
Oh, okay. Good to know.
Do you work around here?
Yeah, I've got an office over there.
25 right. Cabot Square, actually.
I'm Jerry Broughton, and this is We Are the Tudors, listening for the voices of those whose lives have been silenced or lost to history. The other Tudors came to London from many places across the world. John Cabot was from much nearer to home, but he travelled as far away as anyone. His is a story of European expertise and finance, helping the English find their place in the world. Quite a topical story, you might say. Like most of the other Tudors, John Cabot's early life is obscure. He was probably born in Genoa around 1450, then moved to Venice, working in maritime trade, sailing throughout the Mediterranean, and even claiming to have visited Mecca. He was an opportunist. By 1488, he was bankrupt, fled his creditors, and went on the run across Europe. He sold himself as an explorer for hire in Seville and Lisbon. By the beginning of 1496, he's in London, described as a foreigner and a poor man, probably living among the Italian community in the Austin Friars district. But he's smart and resourceful and finds powerful financial backers among London's Italian merchant community. They lend Cabot seed funding to go and find a new land. King Henry VII has watched the Spanish crown finance Columbus's 1492 voyage to the Americas. He wants a slice of the profits and gives Cabot his royal approval. The surviving documents say that although the money and backing came out of London, the leading men in his enterprise are from Bristol and great seamen. Professor Matthew Dimmock writes on Tudor exploration and told me why the King and Cabot chose to work out of Bristol.
Bristol is a westward-looking port at a point when the West is beginning to open up thanks to Columbus. Bristol is also the home of a syndicate of merchants who are very interested in funding voyages that might open up new fishing grounds. So there's money in Bristol to support these kinds of voyages, and they're interested in finding out the potential of what lies to the west.
Having been in Spain, Cabot knew about Columbus's voyage and thought he could also sail west into the Atlantic to reach the east, but taking a higher northerly latitude. Dr. Evan Jones, head of the Cabot Project at Bristol University.
You know, obviously they're not looking for North America. You know, they're looking for China and Japan. I mean, Cabot has bought into the same kind of worldview that Columbus had. He thinks the world is much smaller, that you just sail a few thousand miles west and then you can hit Japan. I mean, if he had been right, Japan would have been well east of New York.
Throughout the summer of 1496, Cabot was in Bristol, working with local financiers and preparing his ship and multinational crew.
We don't know much about Cabot's first voyage. It seems that he received a royal patent in March 1496, so he probably set off and left Bristol on board ship later that summer. Not much is known about the first voyage. There is a record that remains in the archives claiming that Cabot went with one ship. His crew confused him. He was short of supplies and ran into bad weather, and he decided to turn back. A rather underwhelming start to the expedition to the New World.
But another voyage was quickly proposed, and a new ship identified for the Atlantic crossing called the Matthew. Evan Jones showed me round the reconstruction of the ship, built in the 1990s, that's now in Bristol Harbour.
One of the few things we know about the ship, that it was a 50-ton vessel, so it's actually the right size. I think the most scariest thing, actually, it's not just that it was small, but that when Cabot sailed in it, it was the only ship he took. So that meant that he was trusting himself, sailing across the Atlantic Ocean, and if this got into trouble, they were all going to die.
Tell me a bit about Newfoundland, because this is not usually part of the story we think of in terms of the discovery of the Americas by the Europeans.
There's an expectation that there is land going far up to the north. The initial reports of Columbus's voyages suggest that the continent stretches way to the north to a kind of undefined point. Nobody's sure what's there. Nobody's sure what's there at the North Pole. The different maps that were available give wildly different senses of the geography. Cabot is interested, as many people were in Bristol and in England at this point, in trying to find an open sea route that will take them to China, essentially, where they want to trade.
Cabot's second, more famous voyage came in 1497. The records survive state that this year on St. John the Baptist Day, which is 24th of June 1497, the land of America was found by the merchants of Bristol in a ship of Bristol called the Matthew, the which said ship departed from the port of Bristol the second day of May 1497 and came home again the 6th of August next following. I mean, how do we assess the significance of Cabot's voyage and that landfall in North America, Evan?
Well, it was kind of huge because, I mean, everyone knows about 1492. Columbus sails the ocean blue, but, you know, what the area he lands in is the Caribbean islands, Hispaniola and Cuba. Those were the areas of Spanish settlement. The Spanish don't go to any part of North America until 1517. Cabot's was, you know, as far as we know, the first voyage to actually reach North America since the Vikings 500 years before. It might have been tales, legends of that, you know, but it was the first voyage to kind of go in the age of like modern ships and modern map making with people who have a potential to establish trade. And although from Bristol's point of view they don't get any sort of money out of it in the short term, it is something which then sets up the British for thinking, well, this is somewhere we ought to go and colonize from the sort of 1580s onwards. And, you know, they do.
Exactly where Cabot landed has been disputed amongst many historians. Some propose St. John's, Newfoundland, Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia, and Labrador. It's most likely that the first landfall was probably on Newfoundland.
What do they find when they land, and what do we know about where they land and what sort of place it was?
Well, we know that it's Newfoundland. It's named the Newfoundland. But precisely where it is almost impossible to be sure. A few years ago, when the Cabot voyages were celebrated, the 500-year anniversary of the Cabot voyages were celebrated, they had to agree by mutual consent where it was that he landed, and they built a great monument to Cabot there.
The rather forbidding Cabot Tower was built in 1898 to commemorate the anniversary of Cabot's voyage and Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee. But this symbol of the British Empire and its foothold in North America might not have been built without the cunning tenacity of a bankrupt migrant using Italian money to enrich the English crown.
I think he's a bit of a chancer. I think he's a gambler. But above all, what comes across from him as a person is that he had the gift of the gab. He could sell a project. You know, ultimately, all these expeditions, they're about people trying to kind of make money. Then, you know, it wasn't a romantic expedition. I don't think there was a huge amount of romance in Cabot's heart, really. It was about money, and it was about power.
For Cabot, there was to be one final fatal voyage in 1498. In February of that year, he was given new royal patent letters to cover the voyage. Cabot's fleet of five ships left sometime in May 1498. One of the ships was caught in a storm. The other four, including Cabot, sailed onwards. What subsequently happened, nobody knows. It's presumed that Cabot and his fleet were lost at sea somewhere in the North Atlantic.
There are no records of him ever returning. There's some suggestion that the pension that Henry VII offers him is collected in 1598, 1599, but that may have been by his family. There's some suggestions that elements of his crew return or are recorded in London around about the turn of the century. Who knows? That's one of the most intriguing elements of the story, is what happened to Cabot.
Cabot disappeared. But his two voyages paved the way for Bristol's later role in transatlantic trade with the Americas and Africa. By the late 16th century, the Tudors established colonies further south in Virginia. And at the end of the 17th century, the Royal Africa Company was shipping slaves through the city. With the involvement of local merchants, like the now notorious Edward Colston and King William III. The historian David Olushoga sees Cabot's early voyages as the beginning of the inevitable movement and settlement of people.
This period, this Tudor period, is the moment in which England is becoming the maritime power that it's going to be. This is the moment when those ships are leaving those southern ports and we are finding our ways, following the Spanish and the Portuguese and others, to become a seafaring people. Inevitably, any nation that engages in that sort of economy, that sort of global engagement, becomes multi-ethnic, multiracial to an extent, that people, port towns by their nature, are full of people who've come from all over the world. People get on ships, they get off somewhere else, and they build a life. People get off a ship and they get married, or they meet someone, or they find a business opportunity. The fact that some of them have got dark skin and come from the continent where I was born is in some ways no more significant or no less significant than some of them are Italian or some of them are Spanish.
And the results can be seen in the surviving Tudor archives in Bristol in the generations following Cabot's voyages. Anne Lovejoy is senior archivist at Bristol Archives, where staff have been working on a free online database, the Early Black Presence in Bristol Index, that includes many Tudor entries.
I've just got out 4 different parish registers from the late 16th century.
We're in 1578 and we're looking at the baptisms in the register. So can you see here, can you see the name?
Yeah, Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, filia illegitima, so illegitimate daughter of Gilman Ivy. And can you...
Ethiopius.
So that means Ethiopian. Here you can see... we were looking at the burial register for July 1595. And can you see there?
Robert Blackmore.
We've got Robert, yeah, a Blackmore. So a term for someone from maybe North Africa or Africa. So just a kind of little snapshot, really, of black people living in Bristol. We can see here, because of these connections, maritime collections, exploration, lots of the... mariners, merchants in Bristol in this period are involved in trade with Africa.
And how big is the index? I mean, what are we looking at in terms of numbers here that have been collated?
When we published it last October, we had about 500 entries, and now it's almost 800.
An Italian explorer claiming America for a Tudor king. Black men and women, some of them victims of the slave trade. Others living professional lives in Elizabethan Bristol. These are the other Tudors that are part of the story of modern Britain. And their numbers are growing.